This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are just a few hours from Governor Charlie Baker's final State of the Commonwealth address. You'll be able to hear special coverage, including the speech and expert analysis, right here on WBUR tonight, starting at 7 p.m. Before that, we thought it would be fun to put together a bingo card of what you might hear tonight and what you might not hear from the governor tonight. Here to help us do that, Joan Vinacki, columnist for the Boston Globe, and Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican writer and activist. Joan and Ed, are you ready to play some Commonwealth bingo?
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay, great. So listen, listeners, we built this card throughout the day today, 25 squares and a bingo card. Some came from our team. Some came from Joan and Ed. We reached out to some other pundits. You can find the card for tonight at radioboston.org. So, Joan, I'm going to start with you and one of the items from your bingo card that you think for sure we're going to hear the governor talk about tonight.
Well, I think he will definitely talk about his response to COVID. I mean, it's dominated his life for almost 2 years now. And he will mention the high vaccination rate in Massachusetts, because he rarely lets an opportunity go by to not mention that.
Does he have the right to take credit for that, Joan?
Yes. I mean, I think after the rocky rollout, as we've come to call it, the state stepped up and Baker stepped up, and I think he does have a right to take credit for that.
All right, Ed Lyons, what is on your bingo card that you're pretty sure the governor's going to talk about tonight?
I would say keeping schools open. I think this has been a real ideological thing for him, believing that the schools are better off being open. It's been something he's really fought for a couple of years, and I think it's something he cares about and it's something he's had success at.
So he's taken heat from teachers' unions, from some parents. He's felt very strongly about this. What do you expect him to say about it tonight, Ed?
Well, that the data recently released by the Department of Education shows the fact that in-school transmission is very low and that it is working out very well, and that many thousands of days of kids' school have been saved by being strong on this issue.
Joan, do you think that on the list of things he almost certainly will talk about, his using of the National Guard this year for so many different pandemic response purposes, do you think it's likely we're going to hear from him on that?
Well, I didn't have it on my list, but now that you mention it, it sounds like something that would be worth mentioning, because if I recall, he was one of the first governors to do that, and others followed suit. So that showed leadership. And when we at nursing homes and other places, when there were staff shortages and at hospitals, they did play an important role. And it's a nice use of the National Guard.
So, Ed, we also had on the bingo card on our sort of group of things we're pretty sure he's going to talk about, something about the need for bipartisanship, for being in community with each other, for treating each other well in the Commonwealth. Do you think we're right? Do you think that's going to be in the mix? And what do you want to hear from the governor on that?
Well, I hope he makes fun of the legislature for kicking him out so he has to have the speech at the Heinz Convention Center rather than on Beacon Hill, where it should be.
I did not understand that was a move of the legislature to kick him out and make it be at Heinz.
Well, no, I meant the fact that it's close to the public, and I don't think it could have been staged there because they haven't agreed on the rules in which they have to return. So I don't really think it could have been held at the State House. Because there are guests who come there. But anyway, I think he will mention legislation. He's worked very, very well with them over the past several years, that he's really tried to implement the things they want in the best way possible. I think the legislature has passed great stuff on housing and climate. He's got to figure out a way to make these things happen. So I do think he's going to want to lean really hard into his relationship with them and what he can get out of what they've passed.
All right. So, Joan, now, when we were talking to you earlier today, kind of building this bingo card, and again, listeners, you can find it at our website, radioboston.org. Joan, you had some items that you thought basically should be squares on the bingo card, but you don't think anybody's going to use their little red marker on it or stick a coin on that piece of the card. What are one of the topics that you think is on that card and you don't think we're going to hear from the governor about tonight?
Well, not to make light of it, but I wish that we would hear from him about the Holyoke Soldiers Home, but I don't think he will say anything about that tonight. If I'm wrong, I'll be happy to be wrong on that one.
And what do you want to hear from the governor on that?
Well, I'd like to hear more about how he thinks things have changed there and what he's willing to do to change more, if he's going to take up the reforms that the legislature has taken up and I believe the House has acted on. I think we haven't really closed the loop on that. it's far away. It's in Western Massachusetts, and it almost feels a little bit forgotten. And I think it needs more of an end mark from him.
So you're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing here with Ed Lyons and Joan Vanacki. We're previewing Governor Baker's last State of the Commonwealth address tonight, and we thought we'd use a device so we are talking through a bingo card. Ed, your response to Joan that we probably won't hear about the Holyoke Soldiers Home tonight, but we should. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, he can only talk about so many things. I do hope that reforms have been put in place. I imagine they have, but I think he would rather talk about what he could do in the last year on bigger things. I think he'd want to sort of say, yes, the MBTA is better. The Green Line extension is about to open. I think he'll talk about the MBTA. I don't think he's going to dwell on things where there's not that much he can say about what he'll do in the last year.
So I wonder, Ed, let's just stay on that for a second, because sort of trying to put myself in someone else's shoes, it's your last year, it's your last speech, you are unfettered. Do you think that changes what the governor might be willing to reflect on and talk about? I wonder if he might look back at the last 8 years and bring up some things that normally you wouldn't hear from a person who's got more in their term than the last year or maybe running again.
Yes, I think it'll be more of a victory lap, more mentioning of things that he's proud of. I think there'll be definitely more of that than in previous years because it is the last time. However, he's always framed what he can do is what the legislature wants and what the people want. So I don't really think he's going to be this liberated Charlie Baker saying incredible things, making big campaign promises. He didn't really have campaign promises when he ran for office. I don't really think we're going to see some big, bold thing out of him. I think we'll just see him talk about how great our state politics are.
So politics and policy being front and center, we had on our list, Ed and Joan, of things we think maybe should be on the bingo card, but we're not going to hear likely from the governor tonight: voting rights and the state of voting in Massachusetts, especially as the legislature is still in the process, the House side of our state legislature, in the process of taking up a bill that would restore some of the pandemic voting measures that expired back in December. Joan, reflect on that a little bit. Do you expect to hear anything from the governor, and what would you want to hear?
Well, I'd like to hear him say that he supported what you just outlined. I was going to throw out something a little bit different.
Go for it.
I wonder, I'd like to hear him talk about the state of the Republican Party, not just nationally, but
we
here
have
in
that
Massachusetts.
On our list. Go ahead.
where it's so divided. And even though he said it was not the reason why he didn't run, it's hard to imagine that just the nastiness of it all didn't factor in somewhat to his decision.
So, Ed, we've talked with you on this here on the show before a number of times over the last year about the state GOP. Is that something for the governor to address in the governor's role at a State of the Commonwealth? It does affect the state of the Commonwealth. I mean, to think about it from the argument Joan's making.
But not anymore, right? Everything the past year has shown us, the party has no interest in bringing resources to our debates, to being productive, to acknowledging settled issues here. They're not going to be a factor in this governor's race or any other race in the future. I don't like saying that, but I don't think that they're relevant enough for the governor to use his precious time to discuss what's going to happen to them. He has done everything possible to try to make the party viable. He's already called for Jim Lyons to resign. There's nothing left to talk about. It is sad, but it's not a topic, in my view, for the state of the Commonwealth.
And Jim Lyons being the state party chair, and as we often remind people, no relation to you, even though you share the same last name. All right, so the other items from our bingo card that we had on the probably pretty sure this is not going to come up is T's safety record, state troopers, and the potential to run for another office or an endorsement in the gubernatorial race. Fun ones to put on the list. We don't think they're coming. There is this middle group, though, which is, will he, might he, could he, would he? What's on your big question mark, Ed? Something you're wondering if he's going to talk about. You think he might, but you're just not sure.
I'd like him to tell a hokey story. I guess I know that sounds silly, but we're having fun here. And I think he's great at surprising people, like talking about Ted Lasso last year for 30
seconds. That is on the list.
was awesome. So honestly, I think he's such a eat your vegetables guy in terms of government, right? I just want to see him tell something that is hokey and inspiring that you know, people aren't too impressed by, but makes people feel good. We're also worn down by the pandemic. I love to make him have him just lift our spirits a bit.
And I do think it's okay to be a little stressed, playful. We have on the bingo card Netflix or streaming shows, and to explain Ed's reference there, last year during the State of the Commonwealth, the governor made a very specific and detailed reference to the Jason Sudeikis TV show on Apple TV, Ted Lasso, which many people hadn't heard of. And it caused quite the kerfuffle about who is Ted Lasso and why is the governor talking about him. So we did put what is the governor watching on our list of potential. And it is fun to be a little playful. There's so much serious going on. Joan, so what do you think may or may not come up from the governor? You're curious to see what he's going to do with it.
Well, quickly, I mean, I'd love to hear him say that Emily in Paris was his favorite show, but I don't expect it. I'm just kind of wondering, will he cry? And I say that seriously. I mean, he's been known to sort of get emotional and shed a tear or two in certain settings. And this has to be a bittersweet feeling for him. I'm sure that he's come to peace with the decision and he made the decision that he believes is right for himself and his family. But he's been governor for 7 years. He's cast a huge shadow in Massachusetts. Is that the right word? Shadow, big presence. And I think it's going to be emotional. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a little sniffling, but we'll see.
So a couple of others that are on our list of maybe you'll mark your bingo card, maybe you won't. Mandates, mask and vaccine, affordable housing, the transportation climate initiative. The attack on Washington, D.C. on January 6th, we are curious to see if that's a direction he goes. Boston sports teams references. So to finish up here, let's go back to you want him to talk about it. You think he's going to talk about it. He needs to talk about it. And here's what you think we're going to hear. Joan, give us one more.
Oh, okay. We've gone through so many. I mean, I think civility, you mentioned bipartisan results. And I mean, civility has been a big part of what makes Charlie Baker, Charlie Baker. And to me, that does kind of play into what the country needs. And to gently disagree with what Ed said previously, I mean, that's why I think talking about the state of the Republican Party is something that I'd like to hear him address, not because it's a campaign issue or it's anything that affects, I mean, him personally anymore, just because it's what's happening now and the way politics is now is kind of the antithesis of the way he's practiced it. And I really respect the way that he has practiced politics. So I think he would come at it, comes out of it with a lot of standing. And I would like to hear that from him.
And Ed Lyons, last one from you. It's on your bingo card. You think the governor is going to talk about it and you want to hear him say X.
Well, I'm confident he will speak about housing. It's been the number one issue for a long time. The legislature passed a very aggressive bill to require municipalities to finally change their zoning and add more housing. It's going to be a big battle to come. I'd love to hear his thoughts about how we're going to do that.
All right. And folks, a couple more from our list. Mental health, pandemic relief, town and local government, and small businesses are things that we think we're looking forward to. All right. That is our preview done via bingo card, which you can find on our website at radioboston.org of Governor Baker's last State of the Commonwealth speech tonight, which you can listen to live with analysis here on WBUR at 7 p.m. We've had Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe, and Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican writer and activist. Joan, thank you.
Nice to be here.
And Ed, thanks to you, too.
Thank you. I'll bring the card tonight.
Excellent. The commissioner for the Boston Police Department is responsible for overseeing public safety for nearly 700,000 residents of the city and then hundreds of thousands more who come through the city each year. Boston has not had a permanent police commissioner since June, when Dennis White was fired by then-acting Mayor Kim Janey after decades-old allegations of domestic abuse came to light. White had been appointed from within the force by Boston Mayor Marty Walsh at the end of January, shortly before Walsh left office to become U.S. Labor Secretary. So now, here we are. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu has to fill this police commissioner vacancy, and there is a lot riding on it. Earlier this month, Wu named a 5-person committee for the search, including a former judge, a former Boston police commissioner, and 3 community leaders. They are tasked with interviewing and recommending candidates to the mayor for this massive job. So what does the city need in its next head of police, and how do you find that right match? Joining us, Abigail Forrester, executive director at the Center for Teen Empowerment, who is on the mayor's search committee. Abigail, thank you for joining us on Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So the police commissioner is a huge job. If you had to sort of describe it in a couple of sentences, what is the job?
There's this sort of internal responsibility of oversight and management, as you mentioned in the opening, but also this external balance in between looking at the social issues that have been taking place in the community and how do you sort of bridge the responsibility of oversight and management internally with like the community challenges and issues that have a longstanding problem in law enforcement, primarily in the Boston community.
Since the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020, we've had a sustained national, statewide, and citywide conversation about police reform. It is in our sights in a way that arguably it hasn't been in any of the previous police commissioner appointments for, I don't know, how far back you want to go, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. Clearly, Mayor Wu, putting three community leaders, one former law enforcement officer on the panel, has change in sight. How important is that perspective, Abrigail, in your work and in the work of the committee?
Well, I think that perspective is very valuable and important. And you know, I want to give credit to Mayor Wu for going against the norm, right? The norm has been that, you know, a lot of these sort of selection committees have been people who are part of the institutions that we're actually trying to change. This is a different approach. And I think it's very important because the voice of the community and those who are at the hands of law enforcement and have experienced a lot of, quite frankly, some injustices at the hands of law enforcement need to be heard so that not only the antidotes are brought to the forefront, but more importantly, those antidotes lead to change in institutional practices. And so I think it's very important that community members like myself who have a connection to the community can help lift up the attributes that we need for someone who's a leader that, again, can bridge the gap between the external issues and challenges in better policing and what needs to happen internally.
Did it give you any pause when you were invited to serve on this selection committee? I mean, A, it's a huge responsibility, and B, one that will, I'm assuming, receive intense public scrutiny while you do your work.
Yeah, no, it did give me great pause because I didn't put my name in the hat for this. Quite frankly, I got a call that said that my name had come up a couple of times as someone who could add value to this process. And so I did take a deep breath, but I took a deep breath in two senses. One is that, you know, I'm also, my history is that I'm a reentering citizen, grew up in the community, understand a lot of the social issues, been at the hands of law enforcement in ways that people didn't see before cameras came into play. And so I understand that end of the spectrum, but also don't have any challenges around the need for policing. I think law enforcement is important if it's done in the right way. And so my responsibility over the years and as a nonprofit leader and trying to create change in my community had me take a breath, but also say this is an opportunity for me to speak truth to power and put leadership in a position and have a voice in that leadership that can make a difference as we go forward and not have to repeat the cycles of what I've seen in my own personal experience from Rodney King to George Floyd.
Is there a story in your own life that you're willing to share and that you're carrying into this work?
Not necessarily. Again, it's just my lived experience, you know, full scale, you know, on both sides. I'm not only, you know, a reentering citizen, but also I have people in my family. My sister was a Boston police officer. She's a retired. I have extended family that are part of the police force. So I have a purview on this from many different angles that I think can add value.
So I'm going to ask you to sit tight, please, Abrigail. I'm going to add a second voice here, one from law enforcement. Kelly Nee is chief of police at Boston University. Prior to that, she spent more than 33 years with the Boston Police Department. Chief Nee, thanks for joining us. Welcome back.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So how do you, I know you've been listening to our conversation. What do you see as the urgency and the top priority in this selection of a new chief of police, a new commissioner for the city of Boston?
I think the urgency is that the department itself really needs a lot of stability and leadership. I want to commend Greg Long. He's done a phenomenal job of holding it together, but, you know, he's been pretty clear that he didn't want the number one job. And I think that the city and the department are really looking for that solid commitment of leadership to take the department into the next phase.
Gregory Long being the acting commissioner who is serving as an advisor to the search committee. Chief Nee, you have an inside perspective of the Boston Police Department after over three decades there. What are your immediate thoughts on Mayor Wu's selection process for a new commissioner as it's laid out? Is this the right search committee? This fairly unusual step of last week, public comment where, you know, community meetings where people can lay out their priorities, another community meeting tomorrow. How does that differ or compare to what you've seen in the past?
Well, it's really different from anything that I've experienced in my career with the Boston Police Department, but I think it's really well-deserved. I think she's doing a great job. I think this committee is made up of some fabulous and intelligent people, like Abigail said, that will bring in the community's perspective. It's the first time that they've had an opportunity to articulate the characteristics that they would like to see the next police commissioner have. You know, I think the mayor was talking about policing through a lens of public health. And I just think policing is changing. I think we've seen that with police reform. And I think this next commissioner is going to have a lot of responsibility to take the department in that direction, but also to take care of the police officers that have been doing the work and holding it down and have just done an extraordinary job of keeping crime rate down and doing a great job. And, you know, we can't forget that they need to be taken care of, too.
This is Radio Boston. We're having a conversation about selection of the new commissioner of police for the Boston Police Department with Chief Kelly Nee of the Boston University Police Department and Abigail Forrester, Executive Director at the Center for Teen Empowerment and a member of the Mayor's Search Committee. So I'm going to put a question to each of you now. And Chief Nee, I'll stay with you for a second. I'd like you to think of a particular officer in the Boston Police Department, somebody you know, somebody you did know. What is most important, like almost in that bullet list, you know, qualifications portion of a job description, what is most important to that officer in their next police commissioner?
I think, you know, strong leadership, somebody that can bridge the relationship with the community, you know, to reestablish the legitimacy of the police department. Not that they don't have it now, because I do think if you go to the community, we have so much community support in the city of Boston to our police department. But this next commissioner, it's just going to be a different job. I think the members of the department will be looking for strong leadership, good support, taking care of the officers, and just being a really valuable person within the community and listening to the community and understanding what the community needs and wants from their police department.
So, Abigail Forrester, I'll turn to you now and ask you to picture one of the young people that you work with at Teen Empowerment and think about that bulleted list from that young person's perspective. What is most important in terms of qualifications and characteristics in this next commissioner?
Yeah, I would say that that young person would want someone who has the cultural competency to understand that they are more than just the incidents that police pull up to, right? And so this is why there's a huge intersection between public health and policing. It's because there are other issues that are prevalent within the community that lead to the incidents that law enforcement pull up to. And there's a level of sensitivity and understanding about what the community is dealing with that actually impacts the practices of how police approach the community members when it comes to issues that they have to address. And so I think that like level of sort of diverse thinking and cultural competency, I think, is very relevant to the next leader or commissioner for BPD.
So as I listen to the two of you, a couple of things are running through my head. First, yes, that makes sense. What both of you are saying makes sense. And also, that's a lot. It's a tall order. And I don't mean that in a whiny way, like you're never going to get it. But how does one find a person with that skill set? What have they been doing or are they likely doing now in law enforcement, Chief Nee, to have that skill set?
Well, I think you're going to look for somebody who's really already been very, very much engaged with community policing. You know, the Boston Police Department has the Bureau of Community Engagement, and you see what they're doing all the time, being in the community and really listening and contributing to the community and being part of the fabric of the community. I think that's what you're going to be looking for, is somebody that is really engaged in the community, where they're already someone within the police department, within the city of Boston, that brings with them their existing contacts that already have been established, or if they go outside of the city, but somebody who has certainly demonstrated that they can work with the community and really listen and understand what they need.
Well, let's stay with something that you just mentioned there for a second, Chief Nee, which is this staying inside the force versus going outside the force. Abergal, I know in the first community meeting you heard advocacy for both. Yes. Is that correct?
Yes.
And how are you thinking about that? Are you agnostic? I don't have an opinion on that either way. Are you thinking, you know, unless someone surprises us from the inside, now is the time to look outside the department? Have you had any guidance from the mayor on that?
No, I think this is an open process, and I think it's a both and, right? This is about really identifying someone, in my mind, who has the integrity to really address the issues that people are bringing to the forefront from the community angle and from the internal operations of BPD angle. And so, you know, it's an open process. You know, it's a process of whoever, you know, if an individual, you know, rises to the occasion and, you know, they have a good understanding and there's somebody who's already existing internally that brings that open-minded understanding about the balance between the law enforcement technical approaches and community needs and understanding, then that person will rise to the surface. If it's someone external who understands, you know, as Chief Nee mentioned, just different approaches to community policing, but not just being top-heavy in that, but also understanding how to deal with the technical aspects of policing as well and holding the internal law enforcement accountable to their responsibilities, and that's important as well. So we just have to stay open and really take the anecdotes, listen in about the experiences, and then tie that into attributes and characteristics that we're looking for in the next leader of BPD.
Chief Nee, I'm going to turn to you with the same question, hearing you talk about, for example, in your list of what's important, reestablishing legitimacy, understanding that this has been a scandal-ridden department over the last couple of years. You talked about strong leadership. And we know we're in a moment of police reform. So I'm just going to ask you straight up, is this a time to look outside a department if those are the kinds of items that are top of the agenda?
Well, to really reiterate what the executive director just said, is that I'm somewhat agnostic about it. I think you want the best possible candidate. If that person materializes from within the department, then that's who they should go to. I think there's something to be said with either approach. I don't have a preference really one way or the other. I do think this is a time of big change in law enforcement, big change in community's expectations. And I think this committee is well poised to bring some phenomenal candidates before the mayor, and it would have to be somebody that is going to fit with her vision and how she foresees law enforcement evolving under her tenure.
Abergal Forrester, last question to you. In this first community meeting where people came to tell you what was important to them, what is the one comment that stuck most with you?
Equity. You know, equity in treatment. You know, there were ex-officers talking about the inequity of consequences within BPD, right? And then if you flip that and you turn it to the external community, there are issues within the community where there isn't equity in how community members are treated based on profiling, et cetera. So I think the one thing that stands out for me in all of this is how do we make sure that we're identifying someone who has the fortitude to stand up for equitable treatment across the board.
All right. Abergal Forrester is executive director at the Center for Teen Empowerment and is serving on Mayor Wu's Police Commissioner Search Committee. And Kelly Nee is the chief of police at Boston University, served over 33 years in the Boston Police Department. Abergal, Chief Nee, thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You too. We are going to end today with a riddle of sorts. Right now, it appears cases of coronavirus are dropping in Massachusetts from 146,355 new cases 2 weeks ago down to 109,000. 1,703 last week, and that's a good thing. At the same time, Massachusetts nurses last week asked Governor Baker to declare a state of emergency in our hospitals because they are so strapped. Nationally, 27 states had more cases last week than the week before, according to USA Today, but that means that 23 states didn't. All of these things are true at the same time. How can that be? How can we be living in both worlds at once? Well, fortunately, it is Tuesday, which means we have asked the doctors to help us sort it out. What questions do you have for the doctors? Maybe what mask you should be wearing, or when your little ones under 5 will finally be able to be vaccinated. Maybe you're wondering when you can safely see family and friends. Give us a call with your questions, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So the physicians joining us today, Dr. Davidson Hamer and Dr. Benjamin Linus, both infectious disease physicians at Boston Medical Center, both professors at Boston University School of Medicine. BU is in the house. Welcome back to both of you, doctors. I'm going to take that as a yay. I'm happy to be here.
we're welcome to be back. I was waiting for Ben to speak first.
And listen, I was pressing the space bar and my mute wasn't coming out.
There you go. That's all right. And listen, we are going to have a very serious conversation here. And we're going to have many listeners call in with very serious questions. And I get that. It is fun to have a little joy in such a tense time. I understand there was a little trash talking between the two of you during the break over Zoom before you came on. So I expect spirited, although serious, conversation today. Dr. Linus, we haven't had you in a while. I'll start with you. Tale of two pandemics, cases dropping in Massachusetts, wastewater data is improving, a strained hospital system. How can it all be true at once, Dr. Linus?
Sure. I mean, I think that is true. It's a good assessment. And I think some of that reflects the fact that we're not in the same pandemic as we were in 2020, but that doesn't mean that we're not in a pandemic. And so some of the strain that's happening on hospitals now is not an overwhelming flow of critically ill COVID patients who are filling up all of our ICUs and then some. But it's also true that the prevalence of COVID in the hospital is very, very high, and that the severe cases that we do see are more complicated than they have been in the past. Lengths of stay are going up, and also when many people in the hospital are COVID infected, even if they don't have severe COVID, they still generate a resource need and create complexity and logistical challenges in the hospital. And so what we're seeing is that the accumulation of all that has resulted in hospitals filling, and it's not the same dramatic overflow of, lacking ventilators that we had back in April of 2020, but it is still a full hospital with staffing shortages, and it's really starting to take a toll. And so that's, the experience of people, we see cases falling and people are feeling more protected now if they're vaccinated, and that's great. But at the same time, our hospitals are still struggling. And so we can't, as much as people want to be over it, the reality is if we place our heads in the sand to pretend like this is over, the hospitals fill back up again and we end up in this crisis. So it's a really challenging situation.
It makes me think of a quote from Dr. Shira Duron, who sometimes also joins us here on Ask the Doctors, talking to WCVB, where she said, quote, "We have this paradoxical situation where your individual risk is lower than it has been before, but society's risk and the healthcare system are in bad shape." End quote. So, Dr. Hamer, I'm going to turn to you. Dr. Linus just saying more severe cases, lengths of stay going up, people are more sick. We have so much social comment going on about Omicron spreads fast, but you don't get as sick. It's not as bad. So once again, how can both be true?
It's complicated. The Omicron is not the only virus that we're finding through sequencing. There's still Delta and Delta variants out there. And there's still people that are very either immunocompromised or haven't been vaccinated, haven't had the disease, and they're therefore at higher risk. And so sort of the combination of those factors leads to some people being at high risk for ending up in the ICU and potentially progressing to a very bad outcome. I think it's Omicron. If you look at just Omicron in the people infected with that alone, generally they're mild cases, but there are some people that can become sicker. but it's the people that haven't been vaccinated and that may be exposed to Delta, which is still circulating at a low level, that are at risk.
I have not heard Delta brought up in quite a while. Dr. Linus, it sounded like you wanted to add something there. And then
well, I wanted to clarify one piece of what I had said, which is that when I say the cases are perhaps more severe, what I meant to say is that typically when we're seeing severe and critical cases of COVID now, often those are people who, even before they were infected, were struggling with a lot of severe comorbidities. And so when we're managing their severe COVID, it's also in the context of another infection they had because they were on chemotherapy and have a stent placed in their urinary system. And so it's not, you know, at first it was severe COVID and we were struggling with how to treat that. Now we're still struggling with severe COVID and also the comorbidities, which makes those cases very challenging.
And much more complex, as I understand it, to treat both just from the logistics of managing lack of spread and quarantine, et cetera. Right, Dr. Linus?
Do
I understand that correctly?
No, I think that's true. And the logistics of just working in the hospital. I was in the hospital last week and we were doing our rounds and I commented to our fellow that, you know, it's just the simple act of walking room to room is taking us forever because we keep having to put on PPE and break down PPE and put it back on again and break it back down again. So multiply that, those extra 3 minutes that we're taking outside of every single room all day times every interaction across the entire hospital, and it gives you a feel for how it's a different kind of logistical challenge, but it's a real one, and it's starting to have major impact.
It sounds exhausting. Let's go to the phones here, 1-800-423-8255, to ask your question. We've got Chrissy on the line in Shrewsbury. Chrissy, go ahead.
Hi. I thought I would ask the doctors to sort of share with us something that we might not know, something we might be surprised to learn about the contagiousness of all of the variants. Because I think the exhaustion level of everyone is leading us all to make our own assumptions. And I thought it'd be helpful to know something that we may be surprised about, you know, that we've learned over the last 2 years about its contagiousness.
Great. So, Dr. Hamer, I'll turn to you. Something people may not know or we haven't been emphasizing about contagiousness and spread of the virus and our variants.
I mean, a very short version of what's happened is we started out with a wild type virus, as we call it now, from Wuhan, that was, we thought was very contagious at the time, but then nobody was immune to it. Over time, we had some degree of protective immunity through either infection or eventually vaccination. And then we had Alpha. Alpha wasn't so bad, but it was more transmissible. Then we had Delta. Delta spread much faster. It kicked Alpha out. And then in basically December, Omicron came in. And Omicron is so different, so far mutated from previous versions that it our immune system didn't recognize it that well. The vaccines worked, but not great unless you'd had two doses and a booster. And even then, you were not fully protected. Or you were less well protected than you would have been against Delta. And so the virus has evolved over time, and there's a lot of questions about its evolution. But I mean the sort of bottom line is that it's complicated in terms of, I mean, I think Omicron has become the most transmissible variant that we've seen. But the good news is that it seems to affect the upper airway more. It causes more sort of a runny nose, sore throat, cough, but not as much lower respiratory infection where it's not causing severe pneumonia, except in the very immunocompromised individuals that Dr. Linus was describing. So it's the virus has changed, but the transmissibility has increased, but it's become less severe in some ways, except for people that have weak immune systems.
So, Dr. Linus, I'm mindful that the other half of Chrissy's sort of question was people are kind of making up their own rules. So the basic rules of safety right now that one should be practicing regardless, let's hit them.
Sure, absolutely. I think that at this point we can name those things. So one is to be vaccinated and to pursue full vaccination, which at this time means if you're 5 months out or greater from your second dose, to get a third dose. The second thing is I think at this time we still need to be wearing masks in public places. I know that's controversial, somewhat less controversial here in Boston, but certainly nationally it's controversial. But I think that we're in the middle of a major surge. We've just talked about how the hospitals really are struggling. And so it's absolutely true that your personal risk of death from COVID, if you're a fully vaccinated person, is lower than it has been in the past. But societal-wise, we are struggling, and we need to chip in together to get through this surge. So I think it's wearing a mask in public and being fully vaccinated. Those two things really can take you a long way towards both protecting yourself and also helping us get out of the surge situation.
Let's go back to the phones here, 1-800-423-8255 for Ask the Doctors to ask your coronavirus question. We've got Ellie on the line in Newton. Ellie, you are on with Doctors Hamer and Linus. Go ahead.
I have a question about the J&J shot being a two-shot and not three, and specifically I have a relative who got a Moderna shot on top of the J&J in August. So that's coming on over 5 months now, and I'm thinking they need a third shot. And what are people with J&J supposed to do when everybody else is getting three shots?
And thank you for the question, and just to remind listeners, the J&J was a single-dose original vaccine, and then you could get a booster either with a J&J, or it is authorized that you can choose to get an mRNA single shot as your booster, so two shots total. Dr. Hamer, what's your thought on that?
Oh, Ellie, that's a great question and complicated. I mean, the sort of differences between the vaccines are complex in terms of their ability to induce immunity to the virus in general, including antibodies, but also what cell-mediated immunity, which we're understanding is really important for fighting off the viral infection. And then also the differences between variants of concern like Omicron versus Delta. Two doses of J&J actually leads to a pretty strong cell-mediated immune response and a reasonable antibody response. But the problem is that the antibodies may not necessarily be directed at Omicron. And so there's a number of studies that are being done and have been done looking at combinations of the vaccines. I'm not sure I can say what the best combination is right now, but somebody who's had two doses of Johnson & Johnson should be pretty well protected, but probably not as well protected as others who have had two doses plus one of one of the messenger RNA vaccines. But the challenge with all this is that Omicron is so different in terms of its structure and how it affects the immune system that even the best combination, which is two doses of messenger RNA followed by a third dose of one of those, is still not as protective as that combination would have been against Delta. So I realize I'm not giving a direct answer, but this is sort of a process of evolution, and it's not so easy to answer.
So, and it's not as simple then, if I'm understanding you, Dr. Hamer, as you only had two shots and someone else had three shots, so therefore you only have two-thirds of the protection as someone else.
Correct.
Okay, so Dr. Linus, before we go back to the phones, I want to come back to something that you talked about a minute ago. We talked about those basic safety practices, and one of the ones that you said is still mask in public. I want to talk about masks for a minute, because we've been having all kinds of public conversation about what gets referred to as upping your mask game, right? That KN95, that N95, that those are superior to, let's say, using a surgical mask or a cloth mask. So step one, is that correct?
So yes, that's correct. And I think that there are data now to show that cloth masks are certainly less effective than surgical masks and KN95s and above. So I do think that it's worthwhile to move on from cloth masks and try to get a supply of either surgical masks or KN95s at the house. KN95s and KF94s and those higher level masks do provide a little bit more protection than even a surgical mask. A big piece of that extra protection, though, is the fit of the mask as opposed to the mask itself. So I don't think anyone needs to lose sleep if they're holding on to surgical masks and for some reason can't get their hands on KN95s or not in a timely manner. If you just make sure your surgical mask fits well and doesn't have that big pucker on the sides, then you're really getting almost all of the benefit of a KN95. The higher level masks like KN95s then add an extra level of filtration, which is beneficial. But I don't actually think that's a night and day difference. Now, I will say I'm sending my kids to school these days in a KF94 mask. So if it's, you know, I would recommend to folks to go out and try to get a high level mask, but I don't want to invoke panic that if you're wearing a surgical mask now, you're somehow in jeopardy. Just think about the fit.
So one follow-up question.
Can I add to that?
Yes, Dr. Hamer,
Quickly, I fully agree with Dr. Linus. I think, you know, the fit of the mask is most important. It needs to fit tightly around your nose and mouth so that when you breathe, you feel like you're breathing through the mask and not around the mask.
Okay.
And even like a good 2 or 3 ply cloth mask will be good if it's really a tight fit. But surgical masks, if you can get it to fit snugly, they will work well too. Not quite as well as a KN94 or N95, but still will work well.
And in a sentence, because I do want to get at least another call in, Dr. Linus, they're expensive, hard to get. So if one is using a KN95 or a KF94, how many days can one use it safely before you have to start a new one?
Yeah. So I don't. Honestly, I think it'll depend on the mask make and the exact number of days. But I've also found that you can start to tell when your mask is breaking down. I'm sure people have noticed sometimes they get those little tickly fibers on the inside that tickle your nose. It starts to become harder to breathe. Sometimes the elastics start to get stretched out and they're not fitting as well on your ears. When you start to see those things, it's time for a new mask. You certainly can use them more than once. Because they are expensive and they should be recycled, and you should be using them as much as possible.
Okay, so I do want to get one more call. To be fast, I'm going to do the call for her. Lori is on the line from Somerville and is asking, Lori works as an interpreter in a hospital, lives with parents in their 90s, is wearing a mask at home. Should Lori continue to mask at home? Dr. Hamer, just briefly.
Oh, well, that's a hard question because I don't know Lori's vaccination status or whether she's had COVID or both. But with elderly parents like that, I mean, I think she needs to be very cautious. And
let's assume Lori is vaccinated and has not had COVID.
And I would say for right now, I would be really cautious until Omicron dies down a little further. And probably wear a mask when you're in rooms with 90-year-old relatives. Maybe overkill, but better to play it safe for their sake than not.
We're just hearing everyone's vaccinated. Lori has had COVID. Still stay because of Omicron. Still keep those masks on because of the vulnerability of the older adults.
The vulnerability, but also like the ease of transmissibility of Omicron and the fact that it escapes our current vaccines fairly well.
All right. At that, we will wrap it up for today. This has been Ask the Doctors. If we didn't get to your call, I'm sorry. But as you know, we will continue to do these. So you can call again next Tuesday for Ask the Doctors. We've had Drs. Davidson Hamer and Benjamin Linus, who are both infectious disease physicians at Boston Medical Center and professors of Boston University's School of Medicine. Dr. Hamer, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Linus, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Great.
All right, that is our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick and Amanda Beeland. We had help today from Francisca Monahan, Sarah Leeson, and Jack Mitchell. Marquise Neal is our technical director, Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.